This day is called Good Friday. It is a traditional day that a part of liturgical churches originally, and but has been broadly called this otherwise. It is an odd label for the day. The day, Good Friday, commemorates the crucifixion of Jesus. That is the day's focus. And so every year I find myself reflecting again on how to interpret and how to think about the label Good Friday. Well, in order to do that this year, I want to start with something familiar to you, and you probably have seen these letters, WWJD. They used to be on bracelets and on necklaces and all kinds of things. Lots of t-shirts were made with these letters. One of the things that I found rather interesting, though, is that many of the people who wore the bracelets and the t-shirts and all of that couldn't answer the question, what would Jesus do? Because they disconnected the question from who Jesus really is. If you spend a lot of time with somebody, I'm thinking about my dad right now, who I have spent lots of time with through the years. And you, if you were to create a situation and you were to ask me, what is your dad going to do? I'm going to get right even what he says more often than not. Because I've spent a lot of time with him and I know him. And so I have a pretty good way of anticipating what it is he's going to do in some particular situation. So perhaps we ought to institute a new set of letters. And these letters would be better. Here's what these letters would be. WDJD. And that is, what did Jesus do? And that obviously takes us to the Word. Before we begin to think about what did Jesus do, perhaps one of the things that we would just acknowledge is that Jesus did some marvelous teaching. When you study the teaching of Jesus and the ethics of Jesus, the teachings about what's right and what's wrong, you find something extraordinary. You find something in the ethical realm that doesn't have an equal. Let me show you what I mean. This is Matthew chapter 5, just a sampling of Jesus' teaching. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust." The idea here is agriculture. Right? It's the sun and the water that makes the farm, the corn, the soybeans, the wheat, whatever it is you're growing, those two things are essential, aren't they? And God doesn't discriminate. He doesn't give the righteous farmer the sun and the rain and then punish the evil farmer by not giving him the sun and the rain. This is what Jesus says. You should be like the Father. "For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Elsewhere, Jesus says, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you. He continues, but if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. Now, in the modern age, and in fact in every age since Jesus spoke these words, all honest people have responded initially to words like this with something like this. You have got to be kidding. You can't be serious. I get treating people good who treat me good. That makes sense. But people are going to treat me with cruelty. They're going to spitefully use me. They're going to be deceitful to me. They're going to mistreat me in all kinds of ways. And instead of my returning their treatment, I'm going to treat them as if they have been good to me. Well, that's absurd. This doesn't make any sense. But Jesus is unapologetic. These are his teachings. And to be clear, he wasn't kidding. In fact, as I have grown in the Lord, I have come to believe that I am never more like Jesus than when I am treating someone well who has treated me poorly. And I haven't really discovered how challenging it is to do what Jesus says until I've taken up the call to love my enemy. Perhaps if we were to be more reverent, we would say something like this. Jesus preached a call to an amazing, almost unthinkable level of goodness. It's just staggering to think about what it would be like if God's people were serious about loving their enemies. Now, in light of that teaching, I want us to reflect on the crucifixion. Particularly the events that led up to Jesus being crucified. And you can find them in your Bibles or you can track along with me. And I'm going to try to keep this moving because it's long. It's a long passage. But the passage isn't difficult to understand. What I'm asking you to do tonight, and I'm trying to get you to imagine how you would feel if you were treated the way Jesus was treated. What would you think? What would you feel? What would you desire if you were treated the way he was treated? So here we go. Matthew 26, we're beginning in verse 47. And while Jesus was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize him. Immediately, he went up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. Would you let your betrayer kiss you publicly? if you knew that he was using a kiss to betray you to your enemies, would you let him do that? I struggle that thinking I would be able to do that. In fact, I think it's more likely that not only would I have prevented him from kissing me altogether, but I likely would have at least verbally confronted him and rejected him in front of everybody. I think I would have called a spade, as the expression goes. You have a black heart. Something like that. But Jesus said to him, "Friend, why have you come?" And they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him, and suddenly one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. What if your friends came to your aid and began to defend you, even at the risk of their own lives? I think I would thank them. I'm glad I'm not fighting alone. And that dude with the missing ear, he got what's coming to him. Right? That's right. But Jesus said to him, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Or do you not think that I cannot now pray to the Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus?" Jesus commands his followers not to fight. We know from another gospel that Jesus healed the man whose ear had been cut off. Verse 55. "In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled.'" All right, now watch them. Watch all of the disciples run away. What would you do if your best friends deserted you when you needed them the most? Would you ever have anything to do with them again? Verse 57. "And those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none, but at least two false witnesses came forward and said, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days.'" If people lie about you in an attempt to convict you wrongly, how passionately would you defend yourself? Will you not confront the liars and the evildoers and the corrupt? Will you not remind them of God's judgment for their wickedness? Will you not say anything and everything you can muster in your defense? And the high priest arose and said to Jesus, "Do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus thinking something like, well, if the truth is what you're after, you claim that it is. I mean, you're the one that put me under the oath. In our context, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. I have very good reason to doubt that you're actually interested in the truth or that this court is even interested in justice, but because we're not talking about the name of the Father. I'll tell you the truth, even if my well-being, even if my life is not served by telling the truth. It's no big deal to tell the truth when a reward comes for it. What about when you're punished for telling the truth? It's a different whole matter, isn't it? Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy." What do you think? They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands. How would you feel about the people who spat on you and beat you? And how would you feel about the people who made a show of publicly slapping you? If you could, what would you do to such a person? These folks said, "Prophesy to us, Christ. Who's the one who struck you?" How would you feel about the people who added mocking you to all the other mistreatment? The most profound teaching they've ever heard about God has come from you, and they're making fun of you as a spokesman for God. If you could, what would you do to such a person? Now, Peter was outside the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I don't know what you are saying." And when they had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." But again he denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, "Surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you." You sound like somebody that grew up from that part of the country. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man." Immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the words of Jesus who had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So he went out and wept bitterly. What if your eldest and most vocal friend denied even knowing you three times? In your life's most desperate moment, how would you feel? What would it take for that person to ever be part of your life in the future? What would it take for them, for you to be able to forgive them, if such a forgiveness was even possible? Matthew 27, we continue. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. How would you feel if the religious leaders of your community all decided that you were public enemy number one? Think about that. If you're religious people and religious people decide you're public enemy number one, what are they thinking that you are? The devil? That getting rid of you was so absolutely necessary, even if it meant that you must die a vicious and cruel death. What would you wish upon such people? In the same chapter, now Jesus stood before the governor, verse 11, and the governor asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he answered not a word, so that the governor marveled greatly. When you are surrounded by wickedness, lies, deceit, evil everywhere, don't you fight fire with fire? Right? What is good for the goose is good for the gander, right? What goes around comes around. When is enough enough? How is it possible to be peaceful in the midst of such violent intent? Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that they, the Jewish religious leaders, had handed him over because of envy. If you knew that your enemies were your enemies because they were full of envy, they wanted to take away the honor and the praise for the person that you actually are. They wanted to receive that kind of honor and praise for themselves, even though they're not worthy of it. If you knew that, how would you feel? And what would you wish upon them for such a spirit of envy? And while he was sitting in the judgment seat, that is, the governor, his wife said to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said to him, "Let him be crucified." Then the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." If the one person with power and authority to see to it that you receive justice were too cowardly to see to it, how would you feel about them? That person's wife even received a dream warning him not to consent to injustice toward you. Could you ever extend forgiveness to such a person? And all the people answered and said, His blood be on us and on our children. What if many of your countrymen chose pardon and freedom for a violent rebel worthy of punishment over you? An almost entirely peaceful preacher and teacher and minister for God. How would you feel about your own countrymen? What would you wish upon those who liberated violence and punished peace? Might you be thinking and even say, I hope they get what they deserve. Then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. What if people literally beat the tar out of you? Mercilessly. So badly that just a little more beating likely would kill you. With 39 strokes, you were beaten. Each one added to the pain, the suffering, the agony, the abandonment, the injustice, the loneliness experienced in the previous blow. How would you feel about the ones who did that to you? How profoundly and how deeply would you wish upon them everything and more that they were doing to you? Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. You are so beaten and bruised and exhausted, and now your enemies have removed your clothing. It is as if you were an animal. You are not worthy even of clothing. And added to all of the above, you are exposed, you are naked, and there is nothing you can do. They would add shame to your experience. You are the lowest of the low, and they are making sure that you know that is what they think of you, and they are trying to convince others to think of you in exactly the same way. How deep and how powerful would your hatred of them be? When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. So there is more physical and emotional cruelty, more mockery, more ridicule. When will this ever end? When will enough be enough? To what level has your contempt grown? What does justice even look like? How good would revenge feel against people who are so worthy of it? And they spat on him, and they took the reed, and they struck him on the head. More spitting, more abuse. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off of him, they put his own clothes on him, and they led him away to be crucified. This is unbelievable. Can we imagine a day more evil, more vile, more wicked, more unjust, more detestable, and more repugnant? I find myself in these moments saying this: whatever fury Jesus chooses to unleash against his enemies, they most certainly deserve it. Well, here it is. Here it is. There were also two other criminals, led with Jesus to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, here it is, Here's the fury that Jesus is going to unleash on the deserving, evil, vile, repugnant, disgusting people who've treated him in a way we can hardly fathom. Here's the vengeance. Here's the wrath. Here's the anger. Here's the justice. Finally, we get to see it. Nope. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. If ever in the history of all humanity there deserved to be an echo of words, this was one of those moments. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is the day that we call Good Friday. It's made good because of the letters that we started the service with. You remember them? WDJD. What did Jesus do? And this is what makes Good Friday good. Jesus practiced what he preached. We'll never tap the glory of King Jesus. Jesus is what makes Good Friday good. Nobody else did. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for people who come to a service like this and listen attentively, follow the trajectory of your word and allow themselves to be stunned by the greatness of Jesus. Nope, he wasn't kidding when he said, love your enemies. He practiced what he preached. So Jesus, tonight we give you glory. We celebrate you. You are the only thing that made that Friday good. So we honor you tonight. And we celebrate the goodness of your name. Amen.